My name's Ari. I'm an alcoholic. I believe that we left off on page 67, where we said, where it said referring to our list again. Does that sound right? Because I didn't mark my book. Referring to our list again?
That's where
fourth column.
Left my sticky.
Oh, excellent. That makes me happy. Because I have to mark it, or I don't remember. This is my
page 66, I think.
Oh. Yeah.
Turn back to our list.
Turn back to the list?
Isn't that what you said?
I said referring to our list again, so that's 67.
Oh.
Why are you talking? Okay, so just for the sake of my sanity, we're going to start on page 67, on the paragraph that says referring to our list again, because I believe, actually, you know what, let's start on page 66, we turn back to the list, because I like that part anyway. So we had just finished talking about resentment in all its forms, you know, betrayal and disappointment and being let down, and how the idea of resentment was just feeling something over and over and over again as if it had happened 5 minutes ago, even though it happened 5 years ago, or in my case, first grade. And it's funny because when I wrote my first inventory, my sponsor, well, not counting the one I did in rehab when I was 20 that was actually my mom's inventory, they actually handed it back to me and said, this is a nice inventory you wrote for your mom. Why don't you do your own? And I had no idea what they were talking about, and I couldn't do my own inventory because I wasn't in a place yet where I was able to see anything. And it's so wild to now meet people who are in the same spot who just can't get into the place where they've got that vision or that view. They haven't had enough stuff cleared away yet. And, you know, I remember being in that place, and it's horrible. So my sponsor told me to do it chronologically. And she said, go back and think about the first time you felt burned. And I'm like, and I was like mortified because I remember I was like four. That's the first thing I remember. And I could go on chronologically, which is why I had 163 resentments on my first inventory. It turned out they were all the same, you know, at the end of the day when we get to the fourth column, which we will. But when I stopped and I think about the first time I felt that flush of red shame or that burning anger or wanting to throw something or just wanting to run away and slam the door and hide under my bed, it started way, 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 way a long time ago. And it just reminded me how this is so not about the drink. This is so not about alcohol or other substances. This is about the way that I think. And I've thought like an alcoholic since I first could think for myself. And how my instant response to that particular situation, I wasn't getting enough attention. I wanted more attention. I asked for more attention and I didn't get it, was to immediately do something so I could grab the attention away from my older sister. Of course, it was sibling rivalry. And part of that's normal, you know, with siblings. And part of it's like the extent to which I went, the manipulation and the you know, was not normal. Normal kids don't do that. And I was there. You know, I was born this way. And, you know, with a spiritual sickness. And I didn't realize, you know, as a four-year-old or a 20-year-old, but as a 30-year-old, with this program, I realized how spiritually sick I was over time. So we turned back to the list. So they mean our fourth step. For it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, so prior to a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, so maybe it actually happened, maybe we just thought it happened, or didn't happen, they didn't do what we wanted, had power to actually kill us, them, the people who got in the way. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. I was working with a sponsee today, and we were working in a different book that is, you know, an offshoot of the basic text by Joe McHugh, The Steps We Took. And it talks over and over about how self-will cannot fix self-will. You know, it's the most important thing that I need to remember, that if I'm trying to master my resentments, that's a snake eating its own head or eating its own body. You know what I mean? You've seen the picture. It's truly impossible. I'm chasing my own tail. How am I going to master my own resentments? I'm the cause of my own resentments. So we know that at this point, we're going to have to get God involved. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us. And that doesn't mean we're saying they're right. We're saying we just don't like their symptoms and the way they disturb us. They, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And why do we ask God? Because self-will doesn't fix self-will. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Not me, help me save me from being angry. Thy will, not mine, be done." This is so key to think of, in the sense that on my own power, I don't have the strength to look at someone with patience, pity, tolerance, and love. On my own will, I don't have the ability to look at someone who is not acting the way that I think they should and have compassion. If it's affecting me, my compassion goes out the window. You know, if it's affecting me, I'll have compassion for like a little bit, but then I'm like, all right, look, if you're affecting my instincts for, what did we talk about last week, sex, security, society, and all the ways those manifest, ambition, personal relationships, pocketbook, pride, financial and emotional security, if those things are affected, my compassion's like, see ya. And I have to call God to me. I have to call God in and get centered again. It's not like I've been rendered white as snow. I don't always think this way. I'm still an alcoholic. So when I feel threatened, I find this a lot in work for me, because I own a business. So we have my husband and I own a business. We have employees. And so people make mistakes, and sometimes they make mistakes that seem really obvious that you wouldn't make that mistake. And my immediate financial fear, you know, security, ambition, pride, what will people think of us? How will we support ourselves? Blah, 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 blah. And immediately I'm like, I go straight to bitch mode. And, and an alcoholic in her character defects is a most unlovely creature as well, not just in her cups. I come to that place, and I have to get God involved immediately. Like, immediately, I'm like, okay. And I stop and I pray. And if I can't deal with it, I jot down quick inventory and I call one of my people. Because this is always the answer. This is rarely the answer. Even if I'm right, the resentment can kill me and damage other people. So I'm going to read on, but this is so apropos to my everyday life, and I never thought it would apply. Believe me, when I was new in sobriety, I'm like, this is such crap, but it really isn't crap. This is how I don't end up getting sued for, you know, irresponsible employer practices, and it's how I don't ruin my relationships, and it's how I get to have a relatively happy life, because I do avoid retaliation or argument. I wouldn't treat a sick person that way. Mm-hmm. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. And if I cannot be helpful to all people, at least God will show me to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Sometimes that takes a lot of praying. You know, I'm still waiting for a tolerant and kindly view of my mother-in-law. It's been 15 years. I'm not necessarily all that willing to have a kindly and tolerant view of my mother-in-law. So maybe when I get more willing, I'll get more, you know, more of a better view. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the other wrongs others had done. So this is pivotal. If I don't put out of my mind the wrongs others had done, I'm a victim forever and ever and ever. If you stop here, you are giving your life away to somebody else forever. You are like the person who goes to the doctor and sits in the waiting room, but you don't go in for treatment. Or if you do go in to see the doctor, you never get the prescription filled for the antibiotics for the sinus infection you've had for 8 weeks. This is not where it stops. Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. If I don't ask God to fix what's wrong with me, it doesn't matter what you did, because I'm the problem. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? No matter what someone else has done to you, if they cheated you out of something in a business deal, if they stole your car, if they ran over your foot in a parking lot, you still have a part. Even if that part is, okay, so someone runs over your foot in a parking lot, you don't have a part in that action. You have a part in what you do with it afterwards. And that's so hard. It's so hard because they made a mistake. You make them into someone who woke up in the morning and said, today I'm going to roll over someone's foot in a parking lot, and it's you. It's me. It was going to be me. And they planned it. They looked in their crystal ball, and they found me. Ari's going to be at Trader Joe's in Florham Park today, and I'm going to run over her foot. No, that's not really how the world works, because as much as I think about me, that's how much you all think about yourself. No one's thinking about me or my foot in a parking lot. I don't think. I really, really, really hope not. So, where have we been selfish, dishonest, seeking, and frightened? And on the forms that will get me emailed out this week, and again, if you weren't here, you didn't put your name on the list, I'm emailing out the whole packet of forms. Mine was corrupted, and I didn't want to send a bad file, so I had to wait for my sponsor to get back from Kentucky, but she's back, and I'm getting them tomorrow, and I will send everything out tomorrow. This is not the right thing. That's fear inventory. Let me get to resentment inventory. So on the form it says, putting out of our mind the wrongs others had done, I resolutely looked for my own mistakes, though a situation had not been entirely my fault. So I didn't have a part, or I had a small part. I try to disregard the other person involved entirely. Often, this takes prayer. And a lot of times, like I said, the first time you do fourth column work, you need to do it with someone who can help you. See your part. Even if your part is just holding on to the event or the matter after it happened. And you look at, where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Where was I to blame? Ha, that's a terrible word, blame, but we like to use blame a lot. And interestingly, my part is usually not in the primary event. My part is how I like to build it a little house and take it to dinner and, you know, buy clothes for it and have little holiday parties with it. You know, it's like every time something happens, I pull out all of my little resentment friends. And this is how my life was. Every time, from the first time I felt, you know, disappointed about someone's behavior, every time I was disappointed with somebody else, everybody got to come out and play. And that's what resentment does. That's why you end up with 163 people on a list, is because you've never dealt with any of them. Now, if I have like 5 people on a 4th step, you know, that's it, because it's always going to be my immediate family. And because I have such close contact with them, and, you know, 1 or 2 people that I come across. And, you know, I think this year when I did my yearly inventory, my yearly like big inventory, it was only 3 people, which is crazy. And one of them wasn't related to me, which is really kind of crazy, but that's because I go to AA meetings. So anyway, though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely, where we were to blame. The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, you can say character defects, you can say coping mechanisms or instincts run riot, because all of our faults are simply instincts that go crazy. It's not wrong to want security financially or physically or emotionally. It's not wrong to have pride or want appropriate sex relations or personal relations. It's wrong when you thinking that what, when I think what I want is more important than what everybody else wants. It's wrong when I think that what should be, you know, my worldview is more important than your worldview. And it's wrong or inappropriate when the lengths I'm willing to go to achieve, you know, the fulfillment of those instincts is at the cost of other people's well-being, or my own morals or values or what's considered legal or appropriate in the world. You know, if there weren't the rule of law and people just did whatever they wanted, you know, the cars would be all over the road and people wouldn't, you know, I mean, we wouldn't be able to use cars. They didn't have laws for cars when there were no cars. And that's because they figured out that once people started driving, they figured out that they needed things like stoplights and turn signals. Like, the first cars had no turn signals because there weren't enough cars on the road for it to matter. Then they figured out, you know what, we have to do something because people keep turning into each other and it's causing a problem. You know, the reason that I don't have a religious, you know, place to come from with this, but, you know, the simple ideas in the Ten Commandments are, you know, kind of like the simple ideas in the 12 traditions. They're, you know, don't kill, don't steal, don't screw around with someone else's spouse or, you know, significant other. You know, honor your parents and don't dishonor God. And that's a very big piece of, you know, don't dishonor God's planet. Don't dishonor God's creation. And basically, don't be a jerk. Like, that's the whole Ten Commandments. And, you know, all of our laws... I mean, not the one in Connecticut that says a pickle isn't a pickle unless it bounces. There's a really funny website called dumblaws.com if you're ever bored. It's a great place to look at really crazy things. Most of our basic laws are about the preservation of common human life and good sense. And what happens to me when I'm an active alcoholic or an untreated dry alcoholic is that those rules don't apply to me. Those rules don't apply to me. And a lot of my fourth column is I was selfish, dishonest, you know, self-seeking, and all that stuff. And the reason why I was is because the rules don't apply to me. I'm special. I'm unique. I'm an alcoholic. That my whole fourth column was about I don't have to live by the rules because, and I would have some reason. And it was the same kind of trivial reason that it was the same kind of trivial reason that I had to pick up a drink. I can pick up a drink even though I know that probably what's going to happen is I'm going to pass out, black out, cause damage to myself, to my relationships, to other people. But it didn't matter because I was different. Because I was in delusion. I wasn't in denial. You know, this book talks about delusion. Denial is not mentioned. Delusion is utter, complete fantasy world where things are completely different. And that's where I ended up in my behavior when I wasn't living in a spiritual life based on this program. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if you've hung around long enough, you've met people who are physically sober and still living in a way that they're steamrollers. They're people who steamroll through their lives, or people that aren't even alcoholic, who are so set on doing things their own way that they just don't have any idea of how they affect other people. Mm-hmm. And that's where I am before I get to the fourth column. Mm-hmm. I don't have any idea how I affect other people. And this is what I'm looking at. So when I'm writing this list of my, people call them their character defects. So I'm just going to go with the common character defects. I don't like faults because I don't think they're faults. I think that they're the coping mechanisms we had till we learned how to temper them with some spirituality. When I look at my faults, they're going to be things like judgment, arrogance, you know, and they're all going to relate to selfishness, self-seeking, and self-centeredness. But how do I manifest? Sometimes I'm ridiculously nice, like I'm over-solicitous. That's one of mine. I'm manipulative. I'm intellectually prideful. And those are some of mine that then when I get to step six, that's what me and God are talking about. And so I become aware of how I will go into a situation where I'm just going to talk a bunch of intellectual garbage to someone until they just give up and give me what I want because they're sick of hearing me talk, which you are probably getting sick of hearing me talk right now. So where were we to blame? And usually we were to blame because of fear and the need to not lose our sex security society, or that we weren't going to get whatever piece of sex security or society that we thought we were due and might not get if things don't go our way. All of this comes down to, you know, I want my way, or I don't want to lose what I have. And we've all heard that before, I'm sure. The inventory was ours, not the other man's. It's when we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed, that means we make a list, like a physical, actual list on paper. Hang on to it, because it's going to be your six-step list. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight, which means that it's also going to be any place these come up, this is going to put be set aside for your eight-step list also. Don't panic. Eight-step is not amends. Eight-step is the idea that you might someday be willing to make amends to these people, so let's leave that alone. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. I know for me, fear was the thing that kept me from doing things I wanted to do or wanted to try, experiences I wanted to have, or it kept me doing things that were hurting me because I was afraid of what would happen if I tried something different or if I stopped. It explains a marriage and then waiting too long for a divorce with my first marriage. It explains staying in a job like 5 years too long that I really hated. It explains not asking for help because I just didn't know how. I just didn't think that was something that you did. I didn't think asking for help was an appropriate thing to do. That wasn't, you know, how successful people behaved. And the other place that fear really gets connected for me is with old ideas that they talk about in the beginning of How It Works and with old beliefs, because it's like an attachment. Fear is the clamp that holds on to my old beliefs. I'm afraid to let go of my old beliefs because I don't know what's going to replace them. It is so frightening to have something. Sometimes our old beliefs are familial. Sometimes they're societal, like the Barbie belief. Sometimes they're the men don't cry belief, the everything has to look good on the outside belief, and sometimes they're just a personal idea, like for me, that I just kind of had this idea that I was supposed to be extremely self-sufficient from a very young age, and so I was extremely self-sufficient from a very young age, and the idea of, you know, calling my parents from college and saying, you know, I think I'm in trouble, which never occurred to me. Like, asking anyone for help ever, even 10 years into my sobriety, when I was having a problem that actually turned out to be health, not sobriety, I was like, I must need more sponsees. I must need to do more service. I must need to do this. I had an iron deficiency. And I thought that I was, like, dragging and feeling, like, bummed out and my iron was like 3. Like, legitimately, that was the number. It's supposed to be like, I don't know, it wasn't 3. My hemoglobin was like 3 or 4. Like, I didn't have enough red blood cells. And I literally thought that I was feeling low because I wasn't spiritually connected enough. And that if I could spiritually connect myself more by doing more work in AA, that I would feel better. And so I went basically until my friends were like, you don't need more spirituality, you need a doctor. And I'm like, oh. Because that's not how my mind works. I'm still self-sufficient. And we're taught in this program that self-sufficiency is not the answer. I was just a little slow in getting it. That was like 7 years ago. I'm better now. Now I'm like, I don't know. Now I've learned that one of my things is that I can't tell what's alcoholism and what's just my old beliefs. And I ask people, like, you know, my close friends, my sponsor, I'm like, is this me or is this alcoholism? They're like, well, that's you, and you need to deal with that. Like, not in AA. And it's really important to develop that in your life. And it took me a while. I'm really grateful that I have it, though. And doing inventory regularly helps that because it helps me see my patterns of the things that I do regularly as a result of my character defects and the things that are just ingrained patterns that aren't related to character defects. So we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. And sometimes you have fears that are connected to resentments. Sometimes you have fears that stem from resentments. Mostly, though, I have resentments that stem from fears. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Yeah. Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. My last relapse was with a head full of AA. You know, I knew the big book, like, practically memorized. I was sponsoring people and proselytizing the big book, and I had 10 months in, and, you know, I had a situation where I was able to, you know, I was prescribed some medication for a medical reason. My sponsor told me not to take it until I spoke to her. I took it anyway, not as it was prescribed, oddly, and that was it. I was off to the races. You know, because once she said, I told you not to do that, and I'm like, well, it's done now, and that was the end of it. Nobody saw me for like 2 weeks. And, you know, by the time I bottomed out, I was in ICU at Morristown Memorial. So, you know, that's what happens when I don't take direction, not of my own making. The fear inventory, which I will have here on display and will be emailing out tomorrow in the packet of documents, is I listed my fears. Remember to include the fears identified in the resentment inventory. I asked myself why I had them. So why do I have a fear? I'm afraid of snakes, like deathly afraid of snakes, like hyperventilate and pass out when I'm around snakes. And I think it's because of the Indiana Jones, the first movie. I'm using a silly explanation. That's actually true. I'm not, but it's, I was traumatized at a young age by snakes. But did not I myself set the ball rolling? Well, I don't know. I didn't choose to go see that movie. I was only 9. How did self-reliance fail me? Well, this includes considering if my own selfishness and self-centeredness was involved. This is similar to the fourth column of the resentment inventory. Well, I never tried to get help. Like, I never tried to, like, deal with it or desensitize myself to the fear. I just kind of am like, I'm afraid of it. That's all there is. Everyone has to change. Like, we can't go here. We can't go there. You know, there were things I wouldn't do when I went places because I thought there might be snakes. And, like, in the Caribbean, in rainforests, like, I won't go deep into a rainforest because I'm terrified of snakes. And so my husband and my daughter would do things without me because I wouldn't go. That's selfishness. I broke up our family on vacation because I would just not – I'm too terrified of what I might find. And also my pride, because I actually once – we were somewhere and someone came up wearing a long snake that obviously was not, you know, it was a native of the island that photo ops, they get paid, that's their revenue. And I hyperventilated and passed out in front of like 50 people. It was embarrassing. My daughter was 10, you know, and it was really embarrassing. So what perhaps is a better way? That's the fourth column in the fear inventory. The better way might be to get EMDR or go see a hypnotherapist, or, and I've prayed about it, but obviously that's not enough. It's some sort of trauma-related thing that I need to get some help for, and I just haven't done it. But maybe I will, now that I've talked about it out loud on a recording, and the whole world could possibly know. I mean, it's happened 2 or 3 times that I've actually passed out in public. It comes back to pride, you know, it comes back to pride and ego. And don't you know when that thing happened, that thing where I passed out in St. Lucia, we were on a cruise, and the next morning we went down to breakfast and sat at a table, and two of the people that were in the trip with us on St. Lucia sat down at breakfast with us, and they're like, oh, God, there's a lady. And I'm like, oh, my God. Yep, the snake lady. Yeah, it was like humiliating. And so, and that's a really humorous description of how the fear resentment works, or the fear inventory works, but sometimes the deeper level is I have fears because I make them come true in my life. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, so mostly my fear inventory has one word at the end, and it's alone. I'm afraid of being rejected because I don't want to be alone. I'm afraid of not being liked because I don't want to be alone. I'm afraid of what people think of me because I don't want to be alone. And so on and so on and so on. Why do I have those fears? Because I don't think I'm worth anything. Because I think that God doesn't love me. Because I think that, and or because, you know, this happened, or because that happened, and because I'm no good, because I did this, because I did that, because I didn't do this or that, because this is who I was in my past. And that's the I set the ball rolling column. And then what perhaps is a better way? And the better way has always been to see myself as God sees me. It's faith. It's belief. But I can't get there until I've done all of this. I can't decide that, you know, I'm going to let God in where fear dwells until I'm here. And it's a daily process. So, and it's funny because it says, what perhaps is a better way? So does this paragraph. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God, no limits, rather than our finite selves, very limited. We are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. I don't know if that counts with snakes, but I mean, I can tell you that I wasn't praying when I was hyperventilating. I wasn't asking God for help. I was just reacting. I can tell you that in situations that I never thought I could survive, just in the last year, I have had serenity in a way that I didn't know was possible. You know, to go through losses, to go through struggles, family stuff, you know, I'm blown away that when I stop and ask God to give me what I need, how it's right there. And it's very interesting because, you know, they're saying infinite God. They're really drawing the parallel. God is infinite, unexplainable. We are finite. And yet, for some reason, I know that I hear it a lot in these rooms, that people turn around and they forget. I know that I used to do it. I used to give God my bad habits. I made God judgmental. I made God limited. I made God not big enough to take care of my problems. That's me. My God is big enough to take care of all the problems of everyone in the entire universe and people that are not in this universe too. And I was God-like. We're God-like. We're made slightly like God. Now, God's not us-like. That would be a disaster. So we're made in God's image. God's not made in our image. And as long as we remember that we slightly resemble God in our ability to think and make decisions, and that's pretty much it. That's where it stops. There's no like, God, I don't know, God doesn't look like me, and God doesn't think like me, and God doesn't act like me. You know, that's what I need to remember, that my higher power is not comparable to me. I am fractionally comparable to my higher power in that I was given the capacity to love and believe. And that only to the extent that I do that will I get matched 1,000,000% by God. I don't know why I took off my glasses. No, I can't see the book. Okay, here we go. This is really, really important, this paragraph. It's one of the most important things in my program, and I think I use it every day. We never apologize to anyone for depending on our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. So, we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. That is my prayer in every situation. God, please remove my whatever, fear, anger, disappointment, panic, nervousness, whatever, and direct me towards not what you would have me do. Because I don't probably need to do anything. Usually I need to do as little as possible and get out of the way. But what would you have me be? And usually God would always have me be patient, kind, loving, and tolerant. And God would have me be faithful. Or God would have me believe. And you know, I know the answer. Because I've been doing this for a while. I don't always like the answer. I mean, who does? God doesn't want me to be like a raving maniac riding in like a white knight on a horse with a lance into every situation trying to fight my way through the windmill. God wants me to chill out and wait for more to be revealed. This prayer was associated with a rubber band I wore around my wrist in my early sobriety. And every time the feelings overcame me, I would snap the rubber band. This is something my sponsor made me do because I was really a shit show. and it would remind me to say this prayer. And I can't imagine, I don't even know how to tell you the peace that it brought me. Remove my fear. I was so fearful. And direct me towards what you would have me be. A lot of times it was just be where you are. Look at your feet. You know, be here now. Here is okay. Right now is okay. There's nothing wrong in this moment. It's all stuff I'm afraid of or stuff I'm dragging from the past. This moment is fine. There's nothing wrong. And I had it on little sticky notes in my car, and I had it on mirrors in my house. And this little prayer is the most useful tool, one of the most useful tools I've ever found. And I still use it all the time. And it's a real blessing. Mm-hmm. So once we do our fear inventory, and I have one of the things in this, there's a fear inventory prompt sheet, which is really interesting. And it has lots of things on it. And I suggest that if you're, you know, getting the packet by email, that you really take a look at it, because there's some really good stuff on here, like fear of writing inventory. Although I like to think that I sell inventory is a really positive thing, because I get so sad when I go to meetings and I hear people be like, oh, the fourth step's so terrible. I'm like, only if you want to live. But, you know, I don't know. It's I hate to hear people talking down about the fourth step. So now the much lauded talk about sex. I would like to preface this by saying that it's pretty wild that they wrote this so clearly in 1939. Like, they said sex in a book, like, and it wasn't fiction, and it was very clear. There was no, like, and now about marital relations. They were, like, straight up. You know, that's pretty wild and pretty forward, and I know I'm very grateful. And they also talked about how the real deal, unlike a lot of times in the rooms of AA, is that it's really nobody's business but you and your gods, what you do in your personal life. It's not. You have to observe the idea that you're not creating harm, but you don't need to report your goings-on to anyone in AA, and it's not their freaking business. And I think that the fellowship has taken a hold, and I know it's not so bad now as it was maybe 15 or 16 or 20 years ago when I first came in and I was, you know, really smart and got into one of those super awesome early sobriety relationships and was told in no uncertain terms, like, well, you're going to die if you, you know, you're going to drink and die if you, you know, date in early sobriety. And I'm like, yeah, maybe I will, maybe I won't, but, you know, what are you, jealous? Like, you know, here I am, and, you know, I don't know where they are. So, I mean, I learned what I learned. You know, so my personal opinion, which is not the opinion of AA, is that everyone has their own path. And if God is everything, then God's in charge of their life, too. And it is not my business. I am not the arbiter, as it says. So let's go ahead and read it. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. I think they should print that on AA books everywhere. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? So at this point, if I was your sponsor, we'd be doing sex and harms inventory, which looks like this. Whom did I hurt? So you would list the person that you hurt. And this is sex and harm. So I'm not someone who says, write down every person you've ever engaged in relations with, because I don't need to know that. I need to know if there was damage done. This says perhaps begin with the people you've had sex with and branch out to all relations, even those not involving sex. I think that, unfortunately for active alcoholics, pretty much everyone we go near gets hurt. But I think that if you've done a thorough job at this point, that with sponsors' help and God's help, it's pretty clear who you've harmed and who you haven't if you're asking these questions over your conduct in the past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? My favorite, did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Ugh, gives me chills when I read it because I hate it. Where were we at fault and what should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. I could do that all in one night at like a party when I was using, you know? It was like I could create jealousy, bitterness, suspicion. I was selfish. I was inconsiderate. I hurt people. And to me, that was actually sport. It was sport. That was part of how I got validated and got my self-esteem is I just liked to manipulate people and hurt them. And I didn't like to hurt them. I just thought it was fun to puppeteer things around. And I just, you know, you have to use what you've got. And that's what people do. The point is, what should I have done instead? I have to be honest with you. I didn't make up the sex and harms inventory sheet. You know, harms were bigger, like, because I don't know if guys do this, but girls, and I'm being very honest because this is, you know, my interpretation, and I sponsor women. There are girls who will step on the necks of other women who step on the necks of other women for the sake of male attention, and it's pretty common. Or, you know, I'm sure that it happens with males who will push out over their guy friends to get to the next girl or get to the girl that everyone wants. And I'm sure it happens in same-sex relationships also. And so I have hurt more women friends than I've ever hurt men in the pursuit of that particular instinct. And it's not even about getting to the end of the show. It's about just winning. You know, it's competitiveness and winning and validation and how cruel that can be. And I've seen guys do it. You know, I actually know that my daughter is at school right now and there are two roommates vying for her attention and they're doing all kinds of mean things to each other. They tried to out-rose each other on Valentine's Day. I mean, it's cute and funny. They're not trying to hurt each other, but it's like, you know, one got a dozen, the other one went and got two dozen. It's like one got a pound of chocolate, the other got 2 pounds of chocolate. Now she has 3 pounds of chocolate. She brought some home over spring break. It was very nice. And thank God it was all Godiva. But, you know, the point is that it wasn't what should we do different, it's what do we do different now? And I would rephrase the way this sheet says what should we do different. It's like, how would you handle that differently today? You know, I often tell the women that I sponsor, if you can't be honest with someone, you can't be in a relationship. I don't say you need a year. I prefer that you've done half your amends at least. But you're going to have your own experience, and the more I tell you no, the more you're going to do it, because we're all like toddlers. And so I'm just going to say, if you can't be honest, if you can't consider someone else's feelings in your decisions, and you know, then you're still creating harm, and that's what makes you drink, is creating harm. Because eventually the shame of creating harm was what made me pick up every time. So in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for a future sex life. Oh, here we go. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good. And I really wish they said, like, our powers of personal persuasion and stuff, because it's not just about sex. It's about emotional commitment and connection and manipulation and using your whole being to get what you want, whether it's sex or not. It's just sometimes about getting attention. And there are those people that toy with people and get them to, you know, shine in their direction. And they're like, okay, I'm done with you. I just want to go turn someone else's head now. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. I know when I was told I had to write an ideal, I thought it was going to be like a wish list, you know, of everything I wanted in a guy, in a relationship. And I didn't read this part, or I must have not understood it completely, because when my sponsor was like, okay, now go ahead and be that, and I'm like, what? I was so shocked. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. And we'll talk about that when we get to the eighth step. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. So it doesn't say we take it to a meeting. It doesn't say we take it to a group of people. This is a very private thing. The principles are very soundly, you know, grounded in what we learn in the 12 steps, but it's not the kind of thing that you decide by committee. The right answer will come if we want it. And if you don't want it to come, you can ignore it and tune it out. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. My sponsor made me read this a lot when I was new. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. But if we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are the facts of our experience. And I can tell you that these are the facts of my experience, that this is one area where you cannot play games. If you're tied up in something and there's other people getting like hurt, there's spouses or girlfriends or boyfriends, or you're, for lack of a better word, using someone for comfort and not, you know, really caring about them, mm-hmm. Eventually the moment will come where you can no longer get away with it, and you'll either have to really be willing to change, like it says, and move on to better things, or you will pick up a drink, and I know that to be true. So to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. Now, I just want to go back and say that you can put anything where sex is. You can put taking somebody's lunch out of the refrigerator. You can. I'm serious. Any harm that you're doing, gossip, character assassination, stealing, embezzling, which is different than stealing and kind of worse because you're doing it from the people who pay you. Any kind of, like, if you're an insider, you're someone who likes to start shit and then walk away. There's a lot of people that have family members that do that or are the family member that does that. If you're somebody who's cultivating chaos or hurt in a situation and for whatever reason, you like the attention, you like the control, you don't even know why you like it, you just can't stop doing it. I mean, we've all been in situations like you're walking away, you're like, God, why did I do that? If you're not willing to take a look at why you do it and you just keep doing it, eventually you will come to this kind of jumping off point that they're talking about, and where you're either going to have to be willing to move on to better things with God's help, or it's going to take you out. Maybe it won't take you out, but it will take you to the very edge where you're going to wonder, you're going to feel like you're on minute one, 30 seconds in, skin crawling, because the self-loathing gets so much and the shame that it's either pick up a drink or have a complete breakdown and start over like you just got here. I've seen people bottom out from bad behavior in AA. It is ugly. I've seen it, and it's, why do I feel so bad? And you know, it's, well, because you can get drunk on just about anything. Anger, rage, it's all the same stuff. So, at this point, if we have been thorough about our personal inventory and we have written down a lot, we have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct, so that's going to be your eight step list, and are willing to straighten out the past if we can, but we're not there yet, so don't worry. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Perfect timing. So that's where we stop. I'm going to email out if anyone else wants to get on the list. Yeah, I'm going to pass it around.
Oh, okay.
I'm just, how do I stop this?
Okay.
Yeah, and that's it for tonight on the fourth step, and we'll go into Q&A. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.